Phil is going to talk on instrumentalism.
Well, I thank the previous two speakers because I'm going to rely on some of the things they've spoken about, but at the same time there will be a little bit of duplication, but not too much of it. I'm going to talk today about the position in philosophy of science known as instrumentalism. This is just one of several varieties of scientific anti-realism, and I shall try and give a brief review of some of these. Scientific theories often refer to unobservable entities such as quarks, photons, or genes. Should we believe such things exist, or are they just useful fictions? The scientific realist thinks we ought to believe in the existence of such unobservable entities, as are postulated by scientific theories, and that all the objects of scientific knowledge exist independently of the mind of scientists. On the other hand, instrumentalists say that such theoretical entities are just useful theoretical aids to the making of accurate predictions concerning just those phenomena and entities that are observable. In other words, scientific theories must successfully predict observable phenomena and nothing else. Well, it would be nice to discuss the various other forms of anti-realism, but there won't be time, so I'd just like to say a few words about them before turning to instrumentalism. It's brief, but I have included quite a lengthy bibliography in the handout. I would first point out that whilst quite a lot of modern anti-realism is motivated from an anti-scientific stance, this was not true prior to about 1950. And most of the earlier forms of anti-realism were located very much within the scientific community itself, and this applies specifically to instrumentalism. In the 19th century, instrumentalism was really quite a popular view, almost the majority view. And then its popularity faded, more or less with the advent of the great success of Boltzmann's statistical theory of gases and of relativity. But later it returned to popularity as the controversies of quantum theory continued. I have to say, at the moment, it's pretty much an unpopular view, but we won't go into the reasons for why that's the case at this point. So to briefly review some of the other forms of anti-realism, well, in the 19th century there was the anti-realism of Pierre Duhem. Unobservable entities exist, but it is not the business of science to describe them. That is the aim of metaphysics and theology. Also in the 19th century, there was the conventionalism of Jules Poincaré. Theory is underdetermined by evidence, and which theory we choose is a matter of convention, largely socially determined. Then there is phenomenalism. Pretty well a defunct option now. A.J. Ayer famously espoused this view in his Language, Truth and Logic in the 1930s. Phenomenalism maintained that statements asserting the existence of physical objects are equivalent in meaning to statements describing sensations. It may seem an odd view today, but their aim was to avoid talk of the external world, which they regarded as the subject matter of metaphysics. And the philosophical skepticism problems that can follow from using that phrase. And while we are naming prominent anti-realist figures, we must mention the scientist and highly influential philosopher of science, Ernst Mach, who was a vigorous opponent of all metaphysics. He saw science as descriptive and predictive, and not concerned with explanation. And he believed that theories that refer to unobservable entities, including atomic theory, may actually impede inquiry. They should be eliminated where possible in favour of theories involving direct descriptions of phenomena. Mach claimed to be a scientist, not a philosopher, but he was in fact extremely influential philosophically and can be regarded even as the forerunner for Russell's later neutral monism. Mach is a central figure in any discussion of anti-realism, and can be seen as a progenitor of the Viennese school of logical positivism in the 1930s, which has been mentioned earlier. Then there is instrumentalism itself, a term coined, I believe, by the American pragmatic philosopher John Dewey. What we look for in all our inquiries, whether around the house or in the laboratory, is instrumental reliability. We want our theories or concepts to be useful in all situations in which we need them. such usefulness does not imply that the theory is true, nor that the entities involved actually exist. They may just be useful fictions. Instrumentalism takes reliability rather than truth as scientifically central. As I've said, these ideas and debates took place broadly within science itself, or at least within circles friendly to science. One can consider them philosophical debates along the lines of science is a good thing, but what exactly is it aiming to accomplish? But in the latter part of the 20th century, a form of anti-realism developed that was more of a threat to science from outside. This was called social constructivism. Where Kuhn had launched a weak form of social critique of science, in which the way scientists do their work is examined and given social explanations, postmodern constructivists of the 1950s onwards mounted a much stronger form of critique, in which the very findings of science are also subject to social explanation. Scientific knowledge was socially constituted. The people involved here are David Bloor, Bruno Latour, Steve Woolgar, Gilles Deleuze, and others. This is a very interesting topic, and it's a pity we won't be able to discuss it today, but it was very well covered in the April weekend on Objectivity of Science. Well, so there's the background, and now I want to turn to the variety of anti-realism that I'm going to concentrate on today for instrumentalism. Well, the scientific enterprise is motivated from two quite distinct directions. First, there is the desire to understand and explain the world. That word explain is key. To reach a deeper understanding of how the world works and how it is constituted. Second, there is the need to predict how much weight will be needed to move this lever. When will the next eclipse occur? How can the heavens be used to navigate large distances at sea? The urge to penetrate beneath the surface appearance of the world goes back to the pre-Socratics, Thales, Parmenides, and so on. Their attempts to understand the world take the form of what we might now call metaphysical speculation. There is the strong urge to understand the world and to see behind its surface appearance, to explain the world. The requirement that science should successfully predict was less important in Greek culture and had its roots in the more mercantile aspects of man's character. He who can predict can also control. One might add, and make profit. The realist instrumentalist debate in philosophy of science is concerned with these two strands within science and the question of whether or not they are necessarily connected. It seems clear that increased understanding of the world must of necessity lead to an increase in the predictability of the world. But is the converse the case? Does the ability to make accurate predictions necessarily mean that one is using an accurate model of how the world actually is? Are the theories of science that give such good results in terms of their ability to make predictions necessarily true? In the sense of corresponding to some absolute reality that is out there in the world. This is one way, the descriptive way, of framing the realism and instrumentalism question. Do scientific theories always correspond to reality, or are there cases where they are best used in an instrumental way, as abstract systems that give correct results but do not necessarily describe how the world actually is? There is also the normative question of how should science be practiced? Should it be the aim and assumption of science that scientific theories always correspond to reality? Should science always seek both to predict and to understand? If the answer to two is positive, then science should perhaps avoid theories that do not seem likely to represent reality, no matter how good they may be at making predictions. Allied to two, there's a third question concerning what scientists themselves believe they are doing. Is it in fact the aim and assumption of scientists that their scientific theories always correspond to reality? Do they in fact always seek both to predict and to understand? I should argue that while the answer to question three is normally, and may well be, yes, scientists are generally realists, but not always. Niels Bohr was not a realist. In terms of question one, there are compelling reasons to think that scientific theories often do not represent reality. The only way the scientific enterprise can flourish is if scientists generally believe that their theories do in fact correspond to reality. Science must seek the realist path, but in practice many of its theories have to be seen as instrumental. Recently I was very fortunate to get hold of the DVD set of Bronowski's marvellous 19th century theory, Descent of Man. Wonderful to watch it again. And it struck me throughout just how much of a scientific realist Bronowski clearly was, as are most scientists. It was just very obvious from everything he said. Then he said, referring to the alchemists, I won't try and imitate his wonderful words, that seems a terribly childish theory today, but our chemistry will seem childish 500 years from now. A theory in its day helps to solve the problems of its day. Well, that's a highly instrumentalist remark, and perhaps it shows that there may be an almost unconscious instrumentalism in even the most realist society. Well, now I'm going to describe an argument against realism, and then I shall turn to arguments against what I said. They're mainly from Popper. But first of all, an argument against realism. Let's examine the history of our understanding of the macroscopic observable world that culminates in Einstein's general relativity. We find broadly three major theories, those of Aristotle, Copernicus, Newton, I'll group them together, bear with me, and Einstein. While it is easy to look back at Aristotle's science and think of it as completely misguided, it was in fact very good in terms of making correct predictions. However, it was looked on in a realist way, being regarded as an accurate statement of how the world is, and it said that the Earth does not move. Consequently, Copernicus's heliocentric system was initially regarded as purely instrumental. It gave better results as a way of making celestial calculations, but did not represent ultimate reality. Let me expand on this. Paul touched on this to some extent. I'll expand a bit more. The preface to Copernicus' book, De Revolutionibus, said explicitly that the book is intended to be instrumentalist. The contents of the book were not proposed as the truth, rather they presented a simpler way to calculate the positions of the heavenly bodies. The preface, as we've heard, was written by Osiander, and that was more or less on the explicit instruction of Cardinal Bellarmine. The same Cardinal Bellarmine had earlier condemned Giordano Bruno to be publicly burned in Rome in the year 1600. Bruno was a philosopher of nature, supporter of Copernicus, and is regarded by many as a martyr for freedom of thought and modern science. So this is often held against the Church as evidence of its reactionary nature. Well, I am certainly no apologist for the Church, but in many ways this is unfair. There was a very successful science of that day, and Copernicus certainly did not offer a complete new scientific theory. The only way to make sense of what Copernicus said was to construe it in an instrumental way. As Kuhn pointed out, a hitherto successful scientific theory cannot be discarded until there is some replacement theory available that does all that the previous theory accomplished. But at that time, the instrumentalism of Osiander and Bellarmine was undoubtedly the correct line to take, indeed the only line to take. 150 years later, Copernicus' heliocentrism had reached full maturity with Newton's Principia. Now it was, of course, no longer regarded as instrumental, but as representative of ultimate reality. But by now, a complete science had been evolved, and Aristotle's science had been thoroughly falsified. Consequently, from a late 17th century viewpoint, the best that could be said of Aristotle's science was that when it had been used, it was believed to be a realist, but was in fact merely instrumentally useful. If we look at the transition from Newton's system to the current view of relativity, we see a similar situation. The force of gravitational attraction that had been the source of so much controversy, for example, between Leibniz and Newton, and Richard Leff Newton accused of positive occult forces, had initially been regarded by many as purely instrumental. Gradually, by the 18th century, it had become an accepted part of most people's belief systems, and eventually ended up being regarded in imperialist words. But from the post-Einstein viewpoint, while Newton's system remains an extreme utility for prediction, its force of gravity can be regarded as instrumental. Clearly, these scientific theories of the past were, as a matter of fact, instrumental, regardless of how much they were thought to be realist at the time. Even if we accept the normative view of two, that science should seek realism, it is clearly an aim that is very often not achieved, for it is of the very nature of the scientific method that many of today's theories will be eventually discarded, and when they are discarded, they must then come to be seen as having been instrumental. The descriptions of reality offered by Newton and Einstein can certainly give similar predictions, and the thesis of the underdetermination of theory should make this no surprise. However, both theories cannot be ontologically correct. Moreover, what is particularly worrying about the Newton-Einstein case is the extent of the difference in their respective views of reality. If Einstein's system was essentially Newton's with a few tweaks, then it might be reasonable to continue to grant Newton a degree of realism. His system was very close to the truth, but not quite there. And this would fit well with Popper's idea of successive systems having greater verisimilitude, asymptotically approaching the truth.
Could you put that slide?
But the two systems are radically different in their ontology. In Newton's system, the mass and size of an object are absolute properties. In Einstein's, their properties relative to the observer's inertial frame. Newton maintains that space and time are absolute. He describes space as God's sensorium. But for Einstein, both space and time are relative. Newton's universal force of gravity no longer exists. In Einstein, a body distorts the space around it so that everything can be explained by Einstein's version of Newton's first law. A body continues to move in a straight line if acted upon by other forces. But in the presence of a massive body, Newton's straight line becomes a geodesic, so that in moving in an ellipse around the sun, the Earth is following a geodesic within the curvature of space caused by the mass of the sun. There is no sense in which this can be described as a similar description of reality to that of Newton. If Einstein's system is taken as representative of reality, then Newton was radically wrong as a representation of reality, though extremely useful instrumentalist. Indeed, if Einstein's theory is a true description of reality, then all previous conceptions of reality have been radically wrong in assuming size to be an intrinsic property of an object. I have considered in some detail what one could broadly call the science of celestial mechanics. If the argument against realism is effective here, how much more so would it be in the science of the submicroscopic world of quantum theory? For in the former case, we are in the macroscopic world of direct human experience and observation. We can make direct observations of planets, moons, and so on. But the subject matter of quantum theory is largely beyond the scope of human observation. It's largely an abstract mathematical system for predicting effects that we can observe at the microscopic level. To do this, it postulates the existence of various theoretical and unobservable particles, which have certain effects. Some of these particles do not even necessarily conform to our standard two-value system of logic. As a system of prediction, it is extremely successful, amongst the most successful of all scientific theories, yet some of its own inventors, Bohr and Heisenberg, for example, themselves advocated that it should be regarded in an instrumental manner. Let me turn now to Popper's arguments for realism, which I shall criticise. He wrote a paper entitled Three Views Concerning Human Knowledge, and this is collected in his Conjectures and Refutations, if anybody wants to read it. And the paper is a classic defence of scientific realism. It is, of course, very important to Popper to refute the view of scientific theories as just good predictors, for such a view of science is heavily inductive. we clearly believe that a theory will make a good prediction of death, because it has always done so in the past. The popular belief is essentially irrational, so science cannot possibly be merely experimental. He conversely portrays the logical positivist, who he sees as the evil influence behind instrumentalism, as being essentially anti-realists because their verification theory of meaning relies on observability. Well, a great deal of rhetoric in Popper's argument, if you read it, he tends to draw a distinction between logical positivism's verificationism as being allied to instrumentalism on the one hand, and his own falsificationism as allied to realism on the other. He also depicts the realist view of science as giving science some kind of central cultural importance as representative of a rationality going back to the Greeks, whilst depicting the instrumentalist view as allied to the anti-science camp. Science is just plumbing, not to mention the same breath as Shakespeare. Notwithstanding these kind of rhetorical flourishes, if you sort the wheat from the chaff, Popper offers two main arguments for realism that I'll examine here. The first, instrumentalism cannot account for the new discoveries of science, Popper alleges. In other words, if a scientific theory is only an instrument for prediction, then it can only make predictions about things of which we already have knowledge. How could an instrumental scientific theory lead to a discovery of a new planet? Sure, the predictive success of a scientific theory tells us it is in touch with reality. The theory does not represent the world, then why does it give such good predictions? Well, this argument seems pretty unimpressive in the light of the historical facts I've outlined. There are lots of real historical cases in which scientific theories which have been predictively successful and have contributed greatly to scientific methodology have not been true. So that the truth of scientific theories need not be positive in order to explain the successes of scientific practice. Popper's argument does not work. Many scientific theories of the past have turned out not to represent reality. And many of the theories we use today represent reality in ways that are radically different from the theories they replace. Newton is seen as much further from reality than Einstein. But nonetheless, Newton's theory successfully predicted the existence of the planet Neptune. And I hope I got that right. Somebody mentioned Uranus. A rat, probably would. So in this case, the theory that turned out to be instrumental successfully predicted the existence of something new. However, the planet Neptune would probably not have been discovered had not the scientific community of that time taken a realist view of Newton's system. It seems that Popper's argument shows the necessity for the scientific community to have a realist view of their current theories, but this does not mean that those theories are not in fact instrumental. Now, the realist might respond to this by saying that while theories of the past are now seen to be literally false, they were in fact approximately true. But this notion of approximate truth, when you hunt it down, proves to be very slippery and difficult to tie down. And we cannot escape the fact that some of the now falsified theories that gave rise to successful predictions were in some respects radically false, e.g. Newton and absolute space-time. The second main argument of Popper is he alleges falsifiable conjectures are conjectures about reality. A quote, if a theory is testable, then it implies that events of a certain kind can't happen, so it asserts something about reality. So falsifiable conjectures must be conjectures about reality. The fact that they are uncertain and conjectural implies that our knowledge about the reality of this world is conjectural, not that it is instrumental. How would the instrumentalist reply to this? Well, firstly, he would say that the success of a scientific theory does not represent sufficiently powerful evidence, because many previous successful scientific theories have turned out to represent reality in an incorrect way. Secondly, he would readily grant that scientific theories are about reality, but only observable reality. So he would restate Popper's remark as, if a theory is testable, then it implies that observable events of a certain kind might happen. So it asserts something about observable reality. This implies nothing about the reality or otherwise of any unobservable entities involved in the theory. And this is the essential point of instrumentalism. Scientific theories must account for observable phenomena. But unobservable entities used in the theory have doubtful ontology. Now at this point I'd like to turn to Hugh Kuhn and see whether his work, his analysis, casts some light on this, and I think it does. The position we've reached depicts scientists as having a belief in the realism of their current theories, while the ontological claims of successive theories are so different as to suggest that none of them actually represent reality. None of them are true. Some have suggested that Kuhn's philosophy of science points to a resolution of this. I'm not sure, in some respects it does, but at the heavy price of having to accept a relativist view of truth. Take that if you like it. Let me explain it. According to Kuhn, the apparent divergence between what scientists believe and what is actually the case arises because we have assumed a fixed, absolute conception of reality, and a correspondence theory of truth in which scientific theories are true if they correspond to this absolute reality. But why subscribe to either of these views? To begin with, why assume that a God's eye view of reality is possible? Is it not the case that our conception of reality depends upon the conceptual scheme within which we are situated? Or in Kuhn's terms, the paradigm. In his Structure of Scientific Revolutions, he said, the very ease and rapidity with which astronomers saw new things when looking at old objects with old instruments may make us wish to say that after Copernicus, astronomers lived in a different world. We cannot speak of reality absent of the way in which we look at that reality, the way in which we conceptualize it. The pre-Copernican saw the red disk of the sun set below the horizon, where we see the horizon of a rotating earth rise above the fixed sun. We are certain that our reality is the correct one. It has to be correct, for it is ours. Our reality is literally our reality and cannot be other than correct for us. But the pre-Copernican theory did also correspond to reality. Reality is the pre-Copernican conceived. It was not open to the pre-Copernicans to conceive of any other reality, just as we cannot conceive that our reality might someday be superseded. Having a pre-Copernican scientific view essentially involves a certain conception of reality, just as our 20th century view essentially involves a different conception of reality. I stress these are Kuhn's views as I'm propounding them. In an essay entitled Reflections on My Critics, Kuhn argues that a simple correspondence account of the truth of scientific theories will not do when we take account of the way in which the meaning of terms changes between successive theories. These theories are incommensurable. The meaning of words that are apparently the same changes between successive theories. If this is so, then we can only speak of a theory being true to reality within the paradigm in which that theory is formed. So Kuhn's views appear to lend weight to the argument against realism, but at the heavy price of having to accept a relativist conception of truth. Now, I want to talk very briefly about a topic that really deserves a lot longer, because it's a way of resolving the problems that I've been describing. It's called structural realism, but I shall only talk very briefly because we haven't got the time. I think it's the most successful way of dealing with this, in that it seems to me to accept the ontological problems concerning non-observable entities, while recognizing a very real form of progress within science. The term structural realism was introduced by a philosopher of science called John Bowles, though I must say, I don't personally see how it's a form of realism. To me, it comes over more as a kind of instrumentalism. The idea is based on the observation that the errors in scientific theories seem to be about their ontological statements, their take on the nature of the phenomena with which they're concerned. But even though now falsified, they usually turn out to have been correct about the structural relations of them, both the mathematical structure and, more importantly, the causal structure. Worrell says, what Newton really discovered are the relationships between phenomena expressed in the mathematical equations of his theory. Being a mathematician, I would find this interesting. Well, this seems to fit quite well with our transignature of Copernicus Newton. To Einstein, Newton's mathematics does indeed turn out to be a very good approximation to that of Einstein's. And it might reasonably be said that the causal structure of Newton is an approximation to that of Einstein's. But structural realism avoids any attempt at approximate truth for the two different ontologies, and just as well as neither theory seems an approximate form of the other. As I said, this seems a very good theory to me, but I find it puzzling as to why this is seen as a morality of realism, as it says precisely what I have been arguing, that the ontological implications of a theory should be treated with skepticism, while respecting the theory's predictive success and mathematical structure. I'll conclude. The central problem faced by any realist account of scientific theory is how to account for the fact that many successful scientific theories in the past have made ontological statements that later successful theories contradict, despite the fact that those ontologies were fervently believed by the scientific community at the time. Popper and others have argued that a scientific theory must represent reality in order for it to lead to new discoveries. However, this is easily disproved by the many examples in the history of science where theories that are no longer believed but nevertheless they led to major discoveries, thus proving that theories don't actually represent realities. That don't represent reality can lead to new discoveries. However, it seems doubtful that such discoveries could have been made were it not for the fact that the scientific community at the time believed the relevant theories to be correct and represent realities. So my conclusion is that concerning ontology, descriptions of the nature of the external world, scientists must be realists. Historians and observers of science should reserve their realism for cases of overwhelming evidence retaining a skeptical instrumentalist in the meantime. Thank you.